The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
So the last few weeks we've been exploring the Eightfold Path, and tonight, kind of the ending of this series and discussion about the Eightfold Path, I want to explore a little bit about how this path that the Buddha offered supports us in our lives. How does it help us to become happier? And the promise of the Buddha is that we can, in his exploration, he was looking for, is it possible for us to be free from suffering? And his own discovery, he says that it is possible for us to be free from suffering. And yet that freedom from suffering is not a freedom from injury and illness and death. It's not a freedom from things happening in the world, but rather the freedom that he found is possible is a freedom of mind. And his own discovery of a deep happiness that's possible as a particular constricted and reactive qualities of mind can be released. And so his own discovery around what it is possible to be free of, it's possible to be free from greed, aversion, and delusion. And that either may sound like impossible or like nothing, depending on how you perceive things. But the ways in which we relate to experience are often around these three, that we, when something is pleasant, we like it, we want it, we're kind of greedy for it, we want to hold on to it, we want to make sure we can keep it. When something's unpleasant, we don't like it, we want to push it away, we want to not be associated with it. And this is in the range from mildly pleasant or unpleasant to big kinds of pleasant and unpleasant. And so we have this kind of response in all of these situations. And the Buddha pointed to even the subtle kinds of greed and aversion and the delusion that goes along with those, even the subtle kinds of greed and aversion create a stress in our hearts and minds. And so this is what he said is possible to be free of, this kind of stress, this kind of suffering. And so his path, or his what he learned when he found this for himself, that it is possible to be free from greed, aversion, and delusion, he also found at the same time that there's a way, a kind of a path, that will support us in finding our way to this understanding, to finding our own way to recognizing that we too can find our way to a release from these very habitual and very familiar qualities of mind. And so the Eightfold Path. Yes?
Is there someone that has a personalized plate, a van, out here,
a van?
A maroon van.
A maroon van. Anybody here and have a maroon van?
Okay, thank you.
Sorry, thanks. So the Buddha found in his own path, his own practice, that there are some particular tools, practices that will help us to find our way to this freedom from suffering, this release from greed, aversion, and delusion. And this is the Eightfold Path. This is the path that we've been talking about for these last weeks. And so what I'd like to explore tonight is how this path that we've been discussing, wise view, wise intention, wise speech, wise action, wise livelihood, wise effort, wise mindfulness, wise concentration, these tools, these practices of the Eightfold Path, how they help us to find our way towards letting go of greed, aversion, and delusion. How do they support us in this? So first I'm going to read a little bit of what the Buddha had to say about what it's like to be free from greed, aversion, and delusion. He called this kind of freedom the deepest happiness that's possible. In the Pali, it's also called Nibbana, or freedom, or sometimes Nibbana is translated as enlightenment. But the freedom that is being spoken of is not the acquisition of anything. It's not acquiring some great state, but rather it is this letting go. It is a release from greed, aversion, and delusion. This is the definition of this freedom. And here the Buddha says, the extinction of greed, the extinction of hate, the extinction of delusion, this indeed is called Nibbana. And this Pali term Nibbana, actually the word itself has a kind of a conventional or ordinary meaning that means something like to be released, to be cooled. I understand that that word is used sometimes. There are two different things that I've heard it described about. If something is hot, if food is hot or a pot is hot, it will sit on the table and it will cool. It will Nibbana. The rice sitting in the pot will Nibbana as it sits on the table. So it cools off. Very naturally it cools off. It releases its heat. The other way this word is used is if an animal is tied up with a rope or something and then they break free of that rope, it's said that they've Nibbana'd. They have released. They have become free from that tie, that fetter. And so that is the meaning of the word, to be released, to be cooled. And what is it that we are released from? We are released from the grip of greed, aversion, and delusion. And so this is what he says, the ending of greed, the ending of hate, the ending of delusion. This indeed is Nibbana. Enraptured with lust, enraged with anger, blinded by delusion, overwhelmed, with mind ensnared, one aims at one's own ruin, at the ruin of others, at the ruin of both, and one experiences mental pain and grief. But if lust, anger, and delusion are given up, one aims neither at one's own ruin, nor at the ruin of others, nor at the ruin of both, and experiences no mental pain and grief. This is Nibbana, immediate, visible in this life, inviting, attractive, and comprehensible to the wise. And so here the Buddha is pointing to how when we have greed, aversion, and delusion in our minds, we suffer. And not only do we suffer, but we do things that make other people suffer too. Now the suffering, you know, it may not be immediately obvious in some ways, the suffering around greed, aversion, and delusion. But we can, you know, reflect a little bit and recognize that, you know, when we are dislike something, what happens usually when we dislike something? You know, often we may express it in harsh language or do things that, you know, especially if we're relating in relationship to somebody, you know, somebody that we don't like, we may say things to them that hurt them. And so, you know, that sometimes greed, aversion, and delusion in our minds cause us to cause pain to others. But whether or not greed, aversion, and delusion are being expressed outwardly, what this kind of understanding that the Buddha came to was that when we are experiencing greed, aversion, and delusion internally, whether or not it's being expressed externally, when we're experiencing it internally, we are suffering. The experience of greed itself is a kind of a painful, contracted feeling. As soon as greed, as desire or wanting for something springs up, as soon as we want something, there's a feeling of lack. The feeling of greed itself is already a feeling of lack. Now, we don't usually notice this because we are focused on how wonderful it's going to be when we get that thing. We're focused on kind of a fantasy, basically. We're focused on some projection of what it's going to be like in the future when we get it. And so we miss, actually. It's subtle, the feeling, potentially. Although when we start to look at it, when we start to actually be curious about, well, what is the experience of greed like anyway? It's not at all subtle that it is very unpleasant. It hurts. It doesn't feel very good. It feels off. It feels like something's wrong, something's missing. And that's the way greed works. It's telling us that something is missing. Greed is telling us, I have to have that thing in order to fill this feeling of lack, because otherwise I'm going to be miserable. And so this is the story of greed. In effect, this is the delusion that's embedded in greed, that it believes that in order to be okay, in order to not have this feeling of lack, that I need to get the thing that I think I lack. That's kind of the way, that's the delusion that's embedded in greed. And we believe it. And so we, in a way, because of that belief in that delusion and the kind of projecting into the fantasy of having the thing, we actually miss that the experience of greed in and of itself is suffering. And so this is a piece that the Buddha discovered in his own experience of how that quality arising in the heart and mind is painful. And the delusion that's there is, it is just that. In order to be okay, I have to get that thing. The delusion that's in there is a delusion. That one of the big understandings and insights the Buddha came to is that a deeper kind of peace and a deeper kind of happiness is available to us than simply the kind of happiness that comes from getting what we want. And so he did acknowledge that getting what I want is a kind of happiness, that getting rid of things I don't like, that it is a kind of happiness, that it makes us feel good for a little while, but it's not a very reliable kind of happiness. And so in his own practice, he discovered a deeper kind of happiness, and that deeper kind of happiness is actually the release of greed, aversion, and delusion. And so he describes that when lust, anger, and delusion are given up, one experiences no mental pain and grief. That's a pretty strong description, a pretty strong statement. No mental pain and grief. Again, it might seem hard to fathom, and I'd like to kind of explore what this might mean, because it might seem inhuman to not experience grief. You know, if we lose a loved one, you know, it seems very natural to experience grief. And so what might it be? What might it mean? You know, even at that deep level of losing a dear one and not experiencing grief. So in my own exploration around this aspect of the experience, I've seen that the feeling when we have some kind of a loss, there can be an understanding of loss and no resistance to the fact that the loss is happening. And this, I think, is what this not having grief. Grief to me, what I believe is possible to be free of, is the resistance to that loss. And it's kind of an acknowledgement in a way of truth that things happen, that people age, they get sick, they die, that we lose things, that we become separated from what we love, that this is a truth, this is just a truth of life. And a lot of suffering, a lot of our suffering results from resisting those truths, from feeling like somehow, you know, sometimes we feel like I've failed if something happens where I've had a loss. Or we blame somebody else, we feel like somebody else has done something wrong, or maybe we feel like the world is conspiring against us. As opposed to really recognizing and understanding this is truth. This is the way it is. Things are impermanent. They are subject to change. We are all subject to aging, illness, and death. And so the opening to non-resistance to that truth, in my experience, there's a way that the experience of loss can feel very, it's like there's an understanding of the loss and there's a kind of this pouring through of the recognition of that loss and a feeling of what feels like sadness, but it's not catching anywhere. And to me, when there's grief, when the heart is constricted in resisting that loss, it feels like it's tearing at the heart. It feels really painful in that way. It feels constricted and tight. And yet there's a way that our heart cannot resist the loss. And then it may just feel like there's this pouring through of the recognition of the loss and the sadness associated with that. But it's open-hearted. It's not tight. It doesn't have the same kind of pain. And so there can be this recognition of loss, but not the resistance to it. It's coming into an alignment with the truth that this is the way things are. And so no mental pain and grief. This is the freedom of what's possible. This freedom from greed, freedom from aversion, freedom from delusion creates this kind of condition. And so, since this freedom from greed, aversion, and delusion is kind of the direction of our path, and this understanding this, what I've just talked about, how we understand greed, aversion, and delusion as causing suffering and being the way that we not only we suffer, but we create suffering in the world through those qualities of mind. That's kind of the orientation of some wisdom that the Buddha starts with on the path of the Eightfold Path. Wise understanding, wise view, begins with a little bit of this understanding around what suffering is, this kind of constriction around greed, aversion, and delusion. So that understanding is where we begin. And with that understanding, then a kind of intentions are set into place that encourages us to engage in some of the practices that the Buddha suggests in the Eightfold Path. And so if we understand that greed, aversion, and delusion are the roots of the suffering that can be freed from with these practices, the question might arise, how do these tools of the Eightfold Path support that? And so I'd just like to explore that a little bit. We've talked about the Eightfold Path, and it's got these different sections of the Eightfold Path. There's the first two, which are kind of the beginning, the wisdom, the orientation towards what a different way of understanding our experience and understanding how things happen in our lives. And that this whole orientation, that's where the path begins, with a little bit of an intellectual understanding. And then the next section of the path is about ethical conduct. And that's kind of looking at our relationships in the world, how we are with other people. And so this is that part of the path that begins to address how the greed, the aversion, and delusion might be affecting other people. And then the third section of the path, the mental cultivation section that includes wise effortfulness and wise concentration, helps to support how we see that experience internally. When I talked about greed, aversion, and delusion arising inside and not expressing outside, but we still suffer inside. When greed arises, when aversion arises in our hearts and minds, there is a recognition when we turn towards it that that is painful. This is that section of the path helps us to see that and to understand that. And so if we think about how our greed, aversion, and delusion express themselves, they express themselves sometimes through acting out. We engage with other people in ways that, you know, out of greed or out of aversion, that create harm in the world. And so that's one way, one level of how greed, aversion, and delusion express themselves is in our relationships. That's the most obvious level of how greed, aversion, and delusion play out in our relationships in the world. A bit more subtle way that they play out is internally. Just they arise in our hearts and minds, but we don't express them outwardly. But that is where we feel them. There's a pain in there when they arise, when anger arises, when frustration arises, when impatience arises. There is a pain that is suffering in and of itself in our own hearts and minds. And the most subtle level of the way greed, aversion, and delusion happen, I guess. It's kind of an odd exploration, but it's the tendency that we have towards those as habits of mind. That even if they're not happening right now, even if we're not experiencing the reactive emotions, those reactive emotions are based in greed, aversion, and delusion. Reactive emotions such as anger and hatred and impatience and frustration and irritation and greed and confusion and boredom and all kinds of emotions that are that we feel some stress or suffering about. Even when they're not happening, there's a tendency for them to happen if the conditions were to change. That we essentially, because we are so conditioned in the direction, we've been trained so so much in our lives, by our families, by our culture, towards believing that happiness comes from acting on these energies, greed and aversion in particular, that it's so habitual in us that tends to be how we respond if something happens where we feel like something feels a little off, we tend to move into these patterns of mind. And so this is the subtlest level of the way these express. It's like they're almost like, and we kind of have a sense of this sometimes, it's like they're grooves worn in our minds. They're grooves that tend to happen. And so for myself, you know, we all tend to have one of these three. We all tend to have one of them as being kind of our go-to strategy for when something gets tough, And for me, definitely the go-to strategy was the aversion strategy. And so even if I was happy, you know, then you know, the least little thing could change, and it would kick me into an aversion, a frustration, a feeling of self-hatred. And so there's this kind of greased skid into that pattern. And we all have kind of most habitual, perhaps, one of these as most habitual. Some people seem to have more evenly distributed among the three of them, but many of us will have one particular pattern that seems really strong and deeply conditioned. And the Buddha pointed to, it's even possible to shift the mind at such a deep level to become free even from that orientation. That it's even possible to uproot those grooves in the mind, those tendencies towards greed, aversion, and delusion. That's the subtlest level of the expression of those energies. And so the Eightfold Path addresses all three of these layers. The first layer, the most obvious layer of acting out, of engaging with others in ways that creates harm, acting out of greed, aversion, and delusion in our relationships. The section of the path that supports us in this, in not acting in those ways, is the ethical conduct section. The place where we explore refraining from acting to harm others, refraining from taking what's not given, refraining from killing, refraining from taking what's not given, refraining from creating harm through sexuality, refraining from false speech, harsh speech, divisive speech, these kinds of suggestions in this section of the path are actions, activities of body and speech that the Buddha suggests useful to not engage in these, because generally when we engage in these, we are acting out of greed, aversion, and delusion. And so it is a kind of a refraining from action. And yet, in my own relationship to these, this section of the path, it's been very important not to take these as kind of commandments. In my Christian upbringing, the Ten Commandments are very similar in ways. You know, the thou shalt not whatever, thou shalt not kill, thou shalt not steal, very, very similar. And yet my own, you know, understanding as a youth was kind of more, you just don't do these things. And in the Buddha's teaching, there's always an encouragement to explore what's happening. And so in a way, we can look at these encouragements to not engage in certain activities as pointers to explore more deeply, well, what's going on behind it if I want to do something like that? If I want to take something that's not given, if I want to engage in creating harm or saying something harsh, the encouragement is to look at the heart and mind and see what's going on inside, so that it's not simply a blindly following it as a rule, but more of a mindfulness bell, a wake up, wow, that, you know, wanting to say something harsh, what's happening? What's going on? It's a kind of a wake up to be curious about what's happening internally if we want to engage in those actions. But the commitment to refrain from engaging in them helps us to be curious about that energy, not to repress. So this is the kind of way in my own experience that it feels a little different. In my way I understood the Christian tradition, and you know, maybe it was just misunderstanding it. I don't know, but this was how I understood it. In my Christian upbringing, was that you just don't do them. And if you're going to do them, you kind of make yourself not do them. And for me, that was about repressing. You know, it's like, okay, you know, anything that I don't do it. There wasn't this encouragement to be curious about any kind of an energy, you know, a greed or an aversion that might be present. So the exploration here is not about repressing what's happening, not repressing the greed or the aversion, but being curious about it, being mindful of it, bringing that other aspect of the Eightfold Path, the wise effort, wise mindfulness, and wise concentration, to bear on our experience. If we find ourselves kind of slipping towards harm in our relationships. And so this is the most obvious level, this acting out in body and speech. And so this section, the ethical section, supports us in investigating that, not just as a kind of a cutting off, but as a curiosity. So the second level of the suffering that happens when the greed, aversion, and delusion arise in our own experience, but not expressed externally. This, I think, is a deeper understanding and exploration of a kind of suffering that, and we all, it touches all of us. You know, the feelings of not feeling okay in ourselves, not feeling like we're not feeling like we have a happiness, but feeling depressed or confused or angry. And yet, even if it's not expressing itself, we feel the suffering of that. And so that section of the section of the Eightfold Path that touches that is the section on mental cultivation, wise effort, wise mindfulness, wise concentration. And so as we begin to be curious about what's happening, when we are struggling, when we feel like we're suffering, there's any kind of feeling that something feels off or something feels wrong, a feeling of confusion or frustration, the proposal is there's greed, aversion, delusion at work in our own hearts, and it is worth exploring. It is worth opening to and understanding. So this, again, this is a kind of a different relationship to our experience, that we get curious about those qualities of mind, to get curious about what's going on. What is the experience of anger or aversion or confusion or boredom or depression or loneliness or sadness? Typically, our relationship is to follow them, to believe that I need to do something around them in order to find my way back to some kind of happiness. It's a kind of a turning of 180 degrees to open to the possibility that a way to a different kind of happiness, a transformation, might be to be curious about what is the experience of sadness? What is the experience of confusion or boredom or depression? What is that experience? For myself, it was difficult to understand how that turning would be freeing, would be transformative. I think I talked about this a little bit last week, but the usual way that we relate to the energies of greed, aversion, and delusion, all of which are found underneath all of those reactive qualities, those reactive emotions I described, our usual relationship is either to express, to buy into, believe, to follow those emotions, or to repress them, And both of those habitual relationships tend to reinforce the quality itself. It's essentially digging those grooves deeper. Those ruts that I talked about earlier, the kind of ruts in our mind, that as we express or as we follow through or believe that following through those energies is going to help us in some way, we are reinforcing that pattern. And paradoxically, if we try repressing those energies, we're also reinforcing the pattern. And so somewhere in the middle, and actually the Buddha talked about the Eightfold Path as a middle way, in the middle is a place where we explore opening to those energies, neither repressing or expressing. And it feels at first like it's a narrow middle way. How do we do that? You know, open to that, those energies. Like, this is the experience. This is the human experience. What is it like to be a human being that's feeling anger, frustration, sadness, loneliness, boredom? That creates a different relationship to that. That it's kind of like, you know, I might have used this analogy last week too, but it's like when we're following a pattern, it's like we've got our foot on the gas pedal, the gears are engaged, and the pattern is spinning. We are going 100 miles an hour down the freeway with that emotion. Foot on the gas pedal, gears are engaged. And what the practice of being with the experience without either repressing or expressing is like, it's like putting the car into neutral. It's like taking the gears out of engagement. And so when we disengage the gears, in the analogy of the car, when we disengage the gears, the car doesn't stop immediately. It continues. Actually, it continues pretty fast if you're going 100 miles an hour. But you know it will come to a stop because you're no longer giving it fuel. And it functions very similarly as we kind of put our minds into neutral and explore, what is this experience like? It's kind of like we're sitting there trying to steer the car while we don't have our while we have it in neutral. We're trying to steer so we're not going to crash into anything. We're trying to steer it as it comes to a stop. That's kind of what our mindfulness allows us to do, to hold that pattern in a way. And it will wind down. And you will begin to see something that's quite remarkable to see at some points in practice. We can see this watching a pattern or with mindfulness. If we watch some pattern for a while, we may actually see it begin to slow down. We might even see it release. We might even see it go away, disappear. And seeing that, we begin to understand much more directly and experientially how this practice is transformative. Because we can see, we can watch, for instance, a desire end. We can watch a desire end and then realize that desire, which was so compelling, when the thinking that I need to have that thing, it is absolutely essential for me to have that thing in order to be happy. We can watch a desire end and realize that that was completely delusion, that a different kind of happiness happens, and an okayness, a peacefulness comes with the release of that desire. And there's no problem with not having that thing. And so we begin to see the transformative power of this mental cultivation. We start to see our inner reactivity weaken. And over time, it's a slow process, it's a gradual process, but we really see a transformation in our own experience around our habits and patterns, our own habitual familiar ways of reacting in the world. We start to see them get much weaker. We start to see our patterns shift and change. Our mind changes. The deepest kind of uprooting, the uprooting of the tendency in the direction of towards greed, aversion, and delusion, that really requires a deep transformation of understanding. Because the tendency of the mind to move towards greed or aversion is based in ignorance. It's based in the belief that that's the way to happiness, basically. That getting something that I want is the way to happiness. That getting rid of something that I don't want is the way to happiness. And so that's kind of an underlying belief, an ignorance in our system that is very deeply conditioned. It is not hardwired in us, but it is very deeply conditioned. And so it takes a very deep kind of wisdom to transform that. And part of it, part of that ignorance or part of that that kind of belief is based in three fundamental misunderstandings that we have about the world. So the ignorance that prompts us towards thinking that if I get what I want, I'll be happy. If I get rid of what I don't want, I'll be happy, is based in three fundamental misunderstandings. We tend to believe that things that are impermanent are permanent. We tend to believe that things that are unreliable as a source of happiness are reliable as a source of happiness. And the third, most subtle and hard to really understand, is that we tend to take what is not I, me, or mine to be I, me, or mine. And so these misunderstandings, through the practice of mindfulness, we begin to recognize, first of all, through this training, we begin to recognize what's actually happening in our experience as opposed to what we believe is happening in our experience. And so these beliefs around things are permanent, things are reliable, things are I, me, and mine, as we bring our attention to our experience using these tools of wise effort, wise mindfulness, wise concentration. And concentration is really one of the keys here. That as the mindfulness becomes more stable, as it gets established, there's a possibility for us to see much more clearly underneath our experience, to recognize that what we are taking to be permanent is actually not permanent. And so this is what we see as we turn with our experience, turn with mindfulness to our experience. We see that all of our experience is changing. There's nothing stable in our experience. Even things externally that we think are stable and reliable. I mean, even at a level of reflection, we can see that what we think of is stable is not stable. We've had a summer of that, of the fires. You know, just people in their communities losing their homes, some people losing their lives. You know, every day, every single day, somebody wakes up in the morning and it is their last day on the planet. every day, somebody is not aware that it is their last day on the planet. They go off to work in their normal life. You know, some people actually have the fortune in some ways to become aware of when they are approaching their death. But some of us won't. Some of us will walk out the door and think we're going to have a normal day and project our life into tomorrow and tomorrow and tomorrow, and we don't come home from work. We don't come home. We've gotten in a car accident or something has happened. This happens every day. And so even the level of reflection helps us to recognize the impermanent nature of experience. But at a deeper level, we can start to see that anytime we think something is stable, you know, in our experience, this was one practice I did for a little while. It's like, it felt like certain things were pretty solid and rock solid. It's like, okay, well, let me look at that. It feels pretty solid. Let's see, is it actually solid? And beginning to see it kind of break apart into pieces and sensations and change. And so we start to see through this exploration that things are impermanent. They are, it's just like we are in a river of changing experience. There's nothing that lasts for very long. In our experience, nothing lasts for very long. And as a kind of a corollary to that, since nothing lasts for very long, there's nothing that's reliable as a place to hold on to say, yeah, that'll do it for me. I can have that thing and that'll make me happy forever. It doesn't work that way because everything is changing. The not self question is a little harder to describe briefly, given the time. But basically, you know, we take the understanding here is that we take something to be self that is not self. That we impute something to be I or me or mine. And it's kind of related in a way to that taking something to be stable or some kind of an entity, you know, that I exist as some kind of a stable, unchanging entity through time. And there is a kind of a continuity. There is a flow that, like a river, you know, a river. There's a kind of a river that we could walk up to the edge of the river and say, this is the river. But there's nothing about the river that's ever the same for more than a second or half a second at a time. You know, even the riverbed is continually being washed downstream. It's continually changing. There's nothing stable or solid there. And likewise, what we take to be I or me or mine, what we impute as some stable thing from one moment to the next, is a set of changing experience and changing conditions. It's very like that river. It's conditions that come together and flow. But it is not anything solid or stable. And so it's kind of like, you know, you look at something like a tree. Look at a tree, and it looks pretty solid and stable. But again, it's also a process. You know, it started from some kind of a seed or an acorn, you know, a redwood tree. The redwood trees they live a long time. But though they too are not permanent. They start from those little redwood cones or from a little shoot at the edge of one of the other, from a burl, from a tree. They start just some small thing and then they grow and change. And every year they are changing, every year more rings are added. At some point, they will live their life. If they're lucky, they don't get cut down, but, you know, they'll fall over or get blown over by wind or something. And then they'll rot, and other trees will grow on them, and it'll just transform into dirt eventually. This, You know, so we think there's something there that's a tree that's permanent, but it is a process. Even over a very long time, we can begin to understand that process nature. And that's what we are also. We are a process. We are not a thing, an entity. And this also begins to be revealed to us, looking at what we think of as I or me or mine in through these tools of wise effort, wise mindfulness, and wise concentration. Be curious about, well, what do I call I or me or mine? What do I think is me? I've spent a lot of time looking at this. And it's kind of amazing, you know, especially that when you have a strong sense of I or me, and then realize, well, that actually is a strong I or me that's in this particular situation. You know, this is the I or me that's in relationship to this person. And that feeling of I or me isn't there when I'm by myself or with somebody else. And if we have these different senses of I or me, and it can be kind of fun to play with watching them. We're not trying to get rid of a sense of self, but we are trying to understand it for what it is, a process, a change, conditions coming together. And these three kind of misunderstandings, the permanent thinking, taking things to be permanent, taking things to be reliable, taking things to be self, these three begin to be deeply understood to be misunderstandings as we engage in our practice. And that begins to uproot those ruts. Because when we understand at a very deep level that things are impermanent and unreliable, there's no kind of movement to want to hold on to something with greed or push something away with aversion. Because we understand this, it's changing anyway. And so that is how the deeper levels of greed, aversion, and delusion get uprooted. And so that's all the time we have. Thank you for your attention.